19-3614 Western Missouri, United States versus Anthony Whitehead.
Court will hear from Mr. Haley.
May it please the court, Your Honor. This is a case on appeal for Mr. Whitehead regarding both a motion to suppress, in which case he was charged with the possession of a weapon as a felon in possession, and cocaine. And then the jury trial that followed as well, and the finding of guilt. I also want to note that Mr. Kopp did inform me beforehand that in regard to the jury instruction case or the jury instruction claim, that pursuant to case number 966F3rd 700, I guess that has already been determinative, so I will waive that issue at this time and move on to the other issues. And thank you, Mr. Kopp, for telling me that, because I didn't want to look like such a fool in front of the court, not realizing that it had already been ruled on. The first issue I would like to take up is the protective sweep question. This kind of goes to the heart of why the search of the hotel room was necessary without a warrant, in which case the officers could have gone and sought a warrant. Shortly thereafter, when they entered they knocked at the room, Miss Lark, Mr. Whitehead's girlfriend, exited the room unclothed. And I think almost to the day, it was a day like today, except for there was no snow falling on the ground, but it was very cold. It was in January, and she was pulled out of the room naked. They asked her who else was in the room, and she said Anthony, referring to Anthony Whitehead. And the officers asked him to step out of the room. They could see a figure in the back, and he stood up, came around the bed, and walked out the door stark naked, was laid across the door, the threshold parallel to it, his head past the door frame and his feet past the other door frame, with several officers standing over him. Now, Deputy Flanagan of the ATF stated shortly thereafter, one of the other, Deputy Volk, he testified, in fact, that he went back to the bathroom and checked back there. This is a very small hotel room with just the bathroom. And he checked the bathroom first, but noticed as he was coming in this bed with this frame, and it's got this giant box underneath it rather than just a standard bed frame and box frame, and was concerned about that and that might have a person inside of it. And then elected to lift up the mattress. Now, I would note that if he was concerned about this box, this frame, this cavity having a cavity in it, and that there was somebody there, it's surprising to me that he would not have at least asked for backup there to come into the room when they were going to lift this mattress up initially. And by lifting the mattress up all the way, the gun was clear up at the front right-hand corner of the mattress. If you were concerned about somebody being inside of that cavity, I would assume that you'd want several other of your law enforcement officers, fellow law enforcement officers, with you there when you gently lifted up the foot of the mattress. There was a great deal of testimony and focus paid upon this cavity, and it's clear in my brief and by the record in the transcript of the suppression hearing that once they lifted that up, there's a small, thin cotton kind of a pad, and that is to keep the top mattress, from sliding on the plywood. They didn't even bother lifting that up. If they were so concerned that this cavity contained somebody, and again, that's where all the attention was, they never looked in the cavity. I inquired about that, and there was no explanation why this cavity, which inside of this box was such a big deal when they entered the room, and then it's gone. Any concern about it? What's even more salient here, and I don't think that this was noted in my brief, is the fact that the gun was left at the front of that, underneath the mattress at the front. If they were so concerned that somebody was in that cavity, Why did they leave the gun there initially before they came back in?
So what's the significance of all this? Is the significance that this is ineffective protective sweep, that the officers had some other motive for what they were doing? I'm just trying to figure, I understand the factual arguments you're making. I'm just trying to figure out where they lead us.
Yes, that's what I argued, Your Honor. In fact, that I think it was pretextual, the whole thing regarding the cavity and the search there of the bed. Again, if they pay so much lip service to it while they're testifying and even in the police reports, I mean, it's just the record is replete with all of this, these concerns about this cavity, and yet nothing. Once they got outside at that point in time, and I hope that's answered your question, but yes.
It does. And maybe this reflects my own ignorance of protective sweeps to some extent, but does it deviate from the general rule that we don't care about the subjective intentions of the officers? Which is to say that if there was an objective reasonableness in terms of doing the protective sweep, why do we care whether it was pretextual?
And I have to concede that to you, Judge. You're absolutely correct. I'm not going to make that argument. I mean, as far as the objective search was correct. They went into the bathroom. They came through the room, you know, concerned about, you know, this cavity. I just want to point that out for the court. As far as the consent goes, and I know that the case law cuts both ways in the Eighth Circuit, the initial decision in the Williams case that cited to the U.S. Supreme Court case in Jeffers said that even though the room was registered in her name, he does vicariously, or they would state that that's not, doesn't preclude him from having a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, I will concede, in fact, that the later case of the Benguano that was also decided by the Eighth Circuit in 2015 does say that Fourth Amendment rights are personal rights that may not be asserted vicariously. So that case does cut against my, you know, my client's claim that his right to privacy was violated, in fact. As far as the consent that was given by Ms. Lark, I would note, and this is kind of, to me, was the whole key, and this is what my argument was in particular in regard to this. When they had her in that ATF, in the back of that vehicle, the ATF agents did, and she was in there for, I believe it was approximately 30 minutes, close to it, if I'm not correct. Don't hold me to that, but I know it was quite a long time while they were talking to her, and that recording was provided for everyone to listen to. If you'll note, that they kept telling Ms. Lark that they were only, that they found a gun and that they were only interested in the gun and that they were not targeting her for the gun. What they failed to tell her was that cocaine was also found in the room. So by the time she actually consented to the search of the room, both orally and then eventually in writing, which was probably 20 minutes into this thing, with all of the discussion about this gun, we just want the gun, we just want the gun, no discussion of the cocaine. And that placed her in peril. She didn't know about that, and they didn't bother telling her about that. And I think that's very relevant in regard to whether or not this search was consensual.
But no express promise was made to her, right, counsel?
That is correct, Your Honor. I will concede that.
Right. Proceed.
What little time I have left, if there's no more questions, I'm going to go ahead and defer to Mr. Kopp.
Let me ask one more question, which is, once they found the gun, this is sort of strange in the protective sweep. They put it back, and then they left, and they got the consent, as you suggested. Did they need her consent, or did the protective sweep itself, and once they saw the evidence in plain view, provide a means for them to just go out and go back and get it without needing another exception?
You got me on that one.
I was just wondering. I mean, I know the parties didn't brief it, and I've seen cases both ways. So that's why, you know, that's why I'm asking the question. It's a tough question.
That's an interesting question, and I must confess I hadn't thought about that, and it may very, very well obviate the need for the warrant at that point, or the consent at that point in time. So I can't argue that. I could argue it both ways, but I will concede that's a good question.
Mr. Haley, what about the alternative theory of a search incident to arrest under the Padroma case?
Yeah, that's always, I would concede that as well. That's an argument that can be made in this case. I wanted to focus more on the law enforcement's, statements regarding they knew they were going to find a gun and the cavity issue.
Very well. We've used up your time, but I'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
I may not need it.
You're welcome to waive it then.
Thank you.
Mr. Coffey.
May it please the court, my name is Phil Coffey, and I am representing the United States in this case. Yes, I did inform Mr. Haley with respect to the instruction issue. That's Judge Kaye's preference for giving the old reasonable doubt instruction instead of the newer version that was decided in the Lamont Owens case. And I will submit a 28-J letter for the court's consideration. It's mentioned in our brief, but it hadn't been decided yet by the time we filed our brief. The other bit of housekeeping that I wanted to do, and it hasn't come up yet, but I will also put this in my letter, but the defendant was arrested later also with cocaine, and in my brief, for some strange reason, I give the same date, January 20, 2017, and in looking at it, it popped out to me it was June 27, wasn't the same day. It was about 5 months later that he was arrested again in a parking lot with cocaine. That's just a misprint in my brief. Let me talk about the two issues which I think are the most important here. We have raised the question of whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy. The magistrate in his report and recommendation laid it all out and then didn't actually come to a conclusion. Said it was doubtful. Defendant had the burden of proof. We don't know much about the case other than the fact that, and again, this is something I was looking for this in my brief, there were three warrants out for Mr. Whitehead's arrest. And one of them, or both of them, involved the kidnapping of Brittany Lark. So the other thing that occurred, and if you look at the magistrate's report and recommendation, they talked about it, is that Mr. Whitehead was a suspect in a police shooting, or shooting at a police officer. Fortunately, he wasn't hit. So yes, they knew he was armed and dangerous. And so when they knock on the door and Miss Lark enters or answers without any clothing on, there was testimony that they could see somebody in the background, but they didn't know if it was one or two people. It was a fairly small hotel room. It was the time of day. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon or so. It was light outside, but all the blinds were drawn, so they really couldn't see what was going on. And so the testimony was, yes, they asked her, is Anthony here? She said yes. He comes out. He is handcuffed and placed down at the threshold. Now, we have argued in our brief, as we did in our response to his motion to suppress, that under the incident to arrest exception, you really have two things. Number one, you have the question of, was he in a position to actually reach for the gun? The argument counter to our argument is that, well, there was one officer there. He was going to his knees. He was in handcuffs. Going to be very difficult for him to get the gun. But the case law has indicated that that's not necessarily a risk that the police have to take. And especially since we're talking about a very small hotel room, and we're talking about a bed that he easily could have lunged for, he could have gotten the gun. I think it would have been difficult, but certainly not outside the realm of possibility. I think certainly, though, the stronger of the two arguments from the government standpoint is the protective sweep rationale. And under Bowie, you have really two things. Number one is you don't need reasonable suspicion if it's relatively close. And the bed obviously was really very close. And we are talking about an objective standard. I mean, at the suppression hearing, Mr. Haley, as he did today, is arguing not that they didn't have the right to do it, because there was certainly space for someone to hide in there. And again, the officers weren't sure whether we were looking at one or two individuals. His theory is that they were looking for a gun because they really didn't do that thorough a search. And that was pretty much the point he was trying to make. And I have two responses to that, which is, number one, it was pretty clear to me from the testimony, and you could read the record and decide for yourself, that they were able to see enough that satisfied themselves that there wasn't anybody else in there.
Counsel, can I ask you?
Yeah.
This is, Judge Carter asked about the search incident to arrest. You've talked about the protective sweep, and you mentioned that you don't necessarily need a reasonable or articulable facts when it's close by, but we've used words like immediately adjoining. And the question I have for you is, when he's outside the threshold of the room, is that immediately adjoining, or do they, in fact, does that exception not apply and there needs to be some articulable facts justifying the protective sweep?
Okay, I two answers. Number one, he's at the threshold. I mean, he's right at the doorway. They had to walk over him to get in. And we're talking about a very small room. So I think he is, under the case law, close enough. The second thing is that the magistrate found, and we have argued, that even if you need articulable facts, we have them, given the fact that I mentioned the shooting. They had every reason to believe that he was armed. They weren't clear. It wasn't clear if there was another person in the room. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you could say you've got two naked people. We kind of figure out, you know, what they might have been doing. But at the same time, it's not uncommon for three people to be involved. Or, I mean, they really didn't have any way of knowing. And they're arresting these two individuals right outside the room. That could be a very scary situation if there is a third person in there. So to answer your question, I think they were under buoy close enough. And secondly, I think even if we need articulable facts, I think we have them. So I think we have both here. As far as the search is concerned, I'm sorry, the consent is concerned, we also have that. And to answer your question, Judge, I think they were justified in seizing the weapon under the case law that I've read, and we made that argument, that once they see the gun, and part of the reason is, you know, for their own protection, the idea of leaving it there probably wasn't a smart thing to have done, but I think what it shows is they're trying to follow the law. I sit here arguing cases where the argument is, you know, the police have not followed the defendant's rights, they violated the rights, but there are instances such as here where you see cases where, wow, you took a chance here. You know, the argument that I had about him getting the gun, we have two individuals, to leave the gun there doesn't sound like a very smart thing for me to do. But again, I think they were doing that to try to make sure they were going by the book. And that gets to the other question of consent, which is...
I want to follow up on that, which is, we have a case, Varner, from 2007, I think, where they went back and got something illegal. We have other cases that suggest when you leave the evidence there, even though it's in plain view, there needs to be some other exception that applies that allows you to go back, because you have to have the ability to enter. There has to be a right to entry. And so what do you think is the correct approach in these circumstances? Should we go to consent, or should we just say they could go back in the room and take the gun?
I think here we have consent. I mean, so I don't know that I need to answer that. And the argument here was, and I want to make this clear, the argument was not that the consent was the fruit of the poisonous tree. The argument was that the consent was not informed consent. And the whole theory is that they somehow misled her, which, of course, is simply untrue. They told her from the get-go, and they told her repeatedly, you're not a suspect here. And Mr. Haley says, well, but there was that cocaine in the pocket of the pants. Well, there was never any thought on our part that was her responsibility. They're in her pants. We had no evidence that she knew it was there. So we weren't trying to trick her. She was never charged with that. They told her correctly, you are not the focus. The focus is the gun. And at one point she said, well, you know, I'm clear, because you're not going to find my fingerprints or DNA on the gun. And of course they didn't, they found his. So in this situation, I think we have extremely valid consent. She was in custody, but she was informed both by orally and by that form that she signed, that she had the right to withhold consent, which the case law says that's one factor when you're looking at attenuation. I mean, you're looking at time, which we had here. You're looking at purpose and flagrancy, and you really didn't have any flagrancy in my view at all. on the part of the officers. And again, they didn't mislead her. Mr. Haley said they did, but they were absolutely straight with her and told her, you're not the focus. And then she gave consent. So I think we have that here, even if we needed it to get back into the room. I have 8 seconds left, so unless there's a question. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. Mr. Haley, would you like your minute?
Yes, I would, Judge. Just two things. Just a matter of point. Mr. Whitehead is laid across the parallel to the threshold, as I said. He's got several heavily armed law enforcement officers standing over him. The bed, if you look at the photograph of the room, just the closest corner of the bed is easily 5 or 6 feet from the entrance of the door. And that's the closest corner. The corner where the gun was found and where Mr. Whitehead was first observed was on the far corner, front corner of the bed, which would have easily been, I don't know, maybe 10 feet or more away from where he was at with all these law enforcement officers standing over him. My second point about Ms. Lark is this. The cocaine was found in his pants. They didn't say the cocaine. They didn't say anything about where the cocaine was found. They didn't even tell her about the cocaine. And I think that was my point. That's all, Your Honor.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Haley. The court appreciates your willingness to accept the Criminal Justice Act appointment and appreciates the argument of both counsel. Case is submitted and will be.